This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello and welcome to those of you joining us, whether here live on Zoom with TGIF DTRA, or if you're joining us through a replay, streaming online with your favorite podcast platform. Remember, you can find us there looking for decentralized. Sometimes you might have to type decentralized clinical trials because otherwise you may wind up with a whole lot of Bitcoin podcasts. It's time once again for our gatherings here. We do try to gather here just about every Friday. Sometimes life may get in the way, but we cover different topics related to access and participation in clinical trials together with you, this community. The topics come from you. And so if there are topics you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, please feel free to reach out to secretariat@dtra.org, or you can ping Jane Miles, Amir Kalali, myself, Craig Lipset, on LinkedIn or whatever social platform the kids are using nowadays. Can't keep up with them. But while streaming and catching the replays is great, and there are literally now several hundred of these episodes that are available to you in those replays, joining us live is even greater because we'll have that opportunity to have you ask questions. You could post your questions in the chat at any time in the conversation. And as usual, in the second half of the call, we'll open up the room so you can come off mute, jump on camera, and share your questions, experiences, ideas with today's guest. Today's guest is a friend of this community who has been around the block once or twice. And so it is my pleasure to welcome Jim Kramitis with us. Some of us may know Jim for his career that was extensive in the patient recruitment field, spanning CROs and pharma. Some of us may know Jim for his career in the nonprofit association world, in particular, his longstanding time at ACRP, helping to really advance the spotlight on the demands and gaps in the workforce. Some may know Jim for his latest hat, supporting the Site Network community through a new association. And if you're on Spotify listening to us, some of you may just know Jim because of the sweet, smooth tracks of acoustic that he is known to drop on Spotify and other platforms. Whichever way you know Jim, we're delighted to have you here with us. And if you're one of the folks who doesn't know Jim through any of those ways, even better, because now we're going to fill that gap. So Jim, welcome.
Jim, have you ever had a better intro?
I was going to say, that's probably about the best intro I've ever had. Thanks, Craig. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Honestly,
thanks
it's a pleasure.
Thanks for plugging my music, too, by the way. I make a total of about $30 a month on royalties these days.
Jim, I guarantee it's going up to $31.50 in the month of June, and we're not even going to ask for, you know, a percentage of that $1.50 coming back to DTRA.
I'll buy you a beer next time I see you.
With the 10% of the $1.50? I don't want that beer, Jim. Yeah. Jane, you are a Jim Kramitis fan. What was your history together? Where did you first cross paths with this guy?
Well, if you were listening just a minute ago, I disclosed I met Jim because I went to one of his panels at DIA, we'll just say a long time ago. And I remember sitting there, I was on a mission, literally, at that DIA to go learn as much as I could about patient recruitment because. And I don't think it's wrong to say we had just spent $1 million to recruit a single patient. One. And so my mission, my boss sat me down and said, okay, we got to do better. So go figure this out for us, which was okay. It turned into my job. But Jim was doing a session about patient recruitment and using data to really predict how your timelines might look, which was novel. And then how to fit different approaches to different needs. And I was like, oh, this seems so logical and not at all what I've seen so far. And then I made a pact with myself, I'm not missing any more of his talks. So that's how that all happened.
Thanks,
And then
Jane.
he taught me, along with his dear friend Beth Harper, many, many things I use to this day. So thank you, Jim.
I think the information, Jane, I think helped set up your patient recruitment group at Genentech at the time, right? Yeah. I can give you guys the background of sort of how that all evolved. I was at Lilly for a total of 24 years, and the first half of my career was actually in on the commercial side of the business. And at one point, I was running market research for global market research for all of our anti-infectives. And it was interesting because each year, each quarter of each year, we would have our budgets set up for that annual, that fiscal year. And each quarter, in the first quarter, they'd come in, they'd say, cut your budget, our sales aren't meeting expectations. Then the next quarter, cut your budget, our sales aren't meeting expectations. Same thing in the third quarter. And then in the fourth quarter, they'd come back and they'd go, we have too much money. You got to spend as much as you can between now and the end of the year. And after a couple of years of that, I said, what is going on? Like, where's this money coming from? Well, it's coming from R&D. Well, why? Why is that money being spent R&D? So I started poking around, and the bottom line is I figured out that the reason the budgets weren't being spent, the primary reason, there were other reasons, but the primary reason was because enrollment wasn't happening, which meant that patients were not getting into trials, which meant because of fee for service for investigators, the money wasn't getting paid out for the patients' visits. So then I said, well, why is the forecasting so bad? And so I started asking around, and you guys will probably remember this. I asked some of these people, how do you forecast this? And they said, well, it's usually two patients per site per month. And I'm like, that's it? That's all the data you're using? Yeah, pretty much. Doctors tell us they can get two patients per. So I.
Jim, you were ahead of the curve there at Lilly. My joke when I gave a talk once at a meeting of clinical ops people, I asked, what is the science of patient recruitment prediction, right? And this room of 1,000 clinical ops people was dead silent about the science of patient recruitment. So my joke was, the science is the biotech CEO goes to Wall Street and says, our NDA is going to be this date. And then goes home and tells his head in R&D make it work. So they do the math backwards from what's supposed to be the NDA date that the CEO just made up. So that was a, so it, Lily, at that point, you were way ahead just guessing. I mean,
Well, let me tell you, it bingo number one. You're absolutely right. It all comes back to what are you telling the street, right? But I got a lot of pushback. What do you mean a marketing guy coming over here into clinical development telling us what to do? So what wound up happening was the head of operations, who later became the CEO of Lilly, wanted to test Six Sigma as a quality improvement initiative. And he put together a project that I ran along with a couple other people, and we basically showed through Six Sigma that Lilly conservatively was losing $15 million a year by poor prediction of enrollment timelines. And so what we did was we created a department called Global Enrollment Optimization, and we did two things. One was we did a data-driven forecast of what the enrollment timelines would look like, number one. And then number two, if we did need to accelerate the timeline to meet Wall Street expectations or whatever, we deployed different marketing tools. Well, we didn't call them marketing tools, we call them communication tools or educational tools, so that we could go direct to patients and raise awareness of clinical research or a study as an option for them. And the way I used to like to explain it back then was, hey, look, if you're an altruistic person and you want to donate blood to the Red Cross, you can't do it if you don't know where to go and when to go there. So how do we expect people to get into clinical trials if they don't know about it, other than through, if they happen to see the investigator as a physician or something like that? So we started using tools, then we would look at the investment required to accelerate the enrollment. And Jane, we had one of those examples too of $1 million for one patient. It was for an oncology study that happily my department was not involved with that one. But the truth is that's sort of how the whole thing got started. And over time, we were able to bring in the prediction of the timelines much closer to reality than it had been prior. So
Jim, it
that.
feels like, we've got so much better tooling at our disposal when it comes to prediction, when it comes to data access, when it comes to digital platforms for reaching folks, and yet it seems every conference still points to patient enrollment as the big lag in our industry.
Yeah.
Are we ever going to get this right?
I sure hope so, Craig. I mean, I talked to Beth Harper about this, and she says, people are still saying the same things we were saying 20 years ago regarding what needs to be done. But the thing that, first of all, the good news is I think the industry is much more aware of this issue, number one, and number two, there are a lot more tools available to address it. I think one of the areas where we, as an entity, as a clinical research entity, need to, one of the things we need to understand is every protocol is different, and so a tool that works on one protocol won't necessarily work on another. And I ran into that consistently when I was at the CRO. It was Quintiles at the time, IQVIA now, but we'd go talk to sponsors, and they say, "Well, we did advertising and it didn't work." And I'm like, "Well, what were you advertising for?" "Well, it was an oncology study." "Well, and it's almost like a rare disease kind of thing." "Well, yeah, that's not going to work." So you have to use the right tool in the right situation. And Craig, to your point, the tools are better now. You can be much more direct and focused on the patient population than we could back then. We had to use more of a shotgun approach many times, whereas now you can be much more specific with, especially with social media and some of those type of tools, if you're going direct to patient. And direct to patient doesn't always make sense. Frequently, and in many, many cases, going directly to referring physicians makes a lot more sense. But that's a whole can of worms too, in terms of how you use those kinds of tools.
Can I just go into history for one sec? Because this was a while ago. So, not only did people probably scratch their heads saying, "What's a commercial dude doing showing up telling us how to do this?" And what do you mean talking directly to patients? Tell me about that. How did that go? And how did you help people overcome that concern?
Well, for one thing, I changed my vernacular. Instead of calling it marketing, like I said earlier, I called it communication tools or educational tools. Instead of calling it advertising, I called it patient outreach. A lot of the marketing terms had a negative connotation, I learned with the folks on the clinical development side. And I understood why they could see things that way. I think another misconception was, at the time anyway, that marketing, it was funny. Marketing just walked around and went to parties and drank martinis and, rubbed elbows with their customers. It's much, much, much more complicated than that. And there's a lot of data that's used in how marketing materials are targeted, et cetera. So, but the real, Jane, the thing that really helped the most was data. So we showed, here's what happened when we used this campaign within a study at these sites versus these other sites that didn't use the campaign. And we showed the enrollment rates where the again, with the sites that had the campaign on average, with the sites that didn't have the campaign on average, and we could show an acceleration in enrollment. So the data that we were able to collect, and that was an important element of this, is don't just run the campaign, measure the impact. And then we can feed that back to management and to the study team and to other study teams to say, hey, if you spend this much money on this type of study for this type of recruitment program, you will get the following results, more than likely, because the data supports that. Does that answer your question, Jane?
Yeah, and we've come to terms with that term, patient centricity and patient direct to patient now. So now you're moved into this new network, and probably one of the things you're still trying to solve is recruitment, but from a different place in the ecosystem. So maybe you can tell us about what your new organization is focused on and why you got it started.
So it's AMRC, the Association of Multi-Site Research Corporations. And the key word there is corporations. So these aren't just networks, these are companies that own their sites. The criteria for ownership or for membership is you have to have at least five sites that you own where all the employees report into the central group. And you can't, and clinical research needs to be your primary business as a site, not a CRO. So, for example, that some of the networks or the corporations that are owned by the CROs are not eligible for membership because the CRO is really the primary business, if that makes sense.
That's an
So anyway.
interesting distinction. I hadn't appreciated that. So the big CROs, many of whom have tr made acquisitions in this space, wouldn't fit for this association. You're really focused on the pure play site corporations.
Correct, Greg. That's right. That's right.
Interesting.
ACRO represents the CROs. So we figure they don't really need to be part of this. They've got their own representation. But what we're trying to help the industry understand is, patient recruitment is one thing as it relates to operational efficiency, but there are other factors. So for example, contracting. Think about this. If you were a sponsor in a situation where you needed 40 sites and you could go to two of the MCRCs, the multi-site clinical research corporations, you could go to two of those and sign one contract with each of them for 15 patients. So you've got, MCRC number one contract, 15 patients, MCRC number two, another 15 patients. Now you've got two contracts for 30 patients, right? So then you fill in the gaps with the other 10. You might need academic sites, you might need some community sites, you might need some hospital-based sites. So, but historically, what we do is we go one site at a time and we sign separate contracts and we go, it takes a long, long time. You can literally streamline that, starting with the MCRCs for your study and then fill in the gaps with the one-off type of sites, as opposed to the way we currently do it. That in itself saves weeks on the timeline. And the other interesting piece is if you look at the data, the feasibility assessments that MCRCs do compared to traditional site operations are much more accurate. So you're going to get better data in terms of what you're going to receive from these organizations. You're going to be able to sign them up faster. And typically they recruit more rapidly. So there's a number of things. And by the way, I should mention this. There are a couple publications. There was one in DIA, there was one in Applied Clinical Trials that support what I just said. But we're really trying to get more data to show that indeed by working that taking that approach, starting with the MCRCs to sign up your sites, as opposed to handpicking a couple of their sites later on throughout the old process, that will streamline things considerably. So that's one of the primary objectives is helping the industry understand that this paradigm shift is going to have a pretty significant impact on overall timelines and delivery. Then the next part of the equation is quality, right? Speed's great, but not if the quality isn't good.
And I'm
So
sure that's a whole other set of KPIs that, your stakeholders are going to want there. Amir, I know you've got a question on your mind. What's jumping to your mind as you're thinking about the future of multi-site research?
I have a million questions I could ask Jim, so not just one. Jim, you've actually retired multiple times, right? What brought you back from retirement? Like, what compelled you to come back to do the latest gig?
Oh, that's a great question, Amir. I retired from ACRP, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. And I've been doing one-off consulting, different projects. But what really appealed to me about this particular opportunity was the whole dynamic of how it can influence the clinical development ecosystem. The way I like to describe it, to me, there's sort of a futuristic aspect to this that I really like, which is the following. If you look at a traditional business in our world, I'll use manufacturing as an example. There is a flow of things that take place that are very well managed and defined. And it's, we talk about vertical integration. So if you're a car manufacturer, for example, you literally have suppliers all over the world. You have a strategic alliance with those organizations. It's not just transactional. They know how many cars you're planning to make. They know how many parts they need to make for you so you can manufacture those cars. They know when they need to be shipped. There's a complete flow of information and data that transcends the way we currently approach clinical research. So I like, and I'm exaggerating the point to a certain extent just to make the point. But if you look at the traditional way that clinical research has been conducted, sponsor writes the protocol. They throw it over the fence to the CRO. They look at it and go, geez, man, I would have done things a little different, but it's what it is. They throw it over the fence to the sites, and the sites are the ones that really get the raw deal without, because they haven't had any input. If we could function more like a manufacturing, and I get there's a huge difference because we're talking about human beings and the variance and how people look at things and do things. But right now, there's such an opportunity for us to do it more efficiently and effectively through better communication, through more strategic alliances, and better communication all the way from the patient, even in protocol design, from the site, from the CRO with the sponsor, and those four stakeholder groups working together to develop strategic relationships and better communications. That would really make a difference in this industry. So to answer your question, that's what appealed to me about it, because I think we have an opportunity to leverage these corporations to help make that happen more efficiently.
Yeah, the pattern I see when I said you retired from Lilly and other places, right? It wasn't just one retirement. But what I see from your Lilly story, which you told here today as well, is you kind of saw a problem that wasn't even in your kind of division, right? And you sort of thought, I can really help with this. So I see you as someone who, sees the problem there that you can maybe help, right? And go and fix with what you know, which is great. I guess with your latest gig, the way I will conceptualize it is kind of the wave of private equity. So private equity, bought all the CROs they could, right? They weren't public. They bought all the vendors they could, So most of our vendors are now private equity backed. So I guess there was only sites left to buy, right? So now sites are being bought at scale. I would imagine the and since COVID, you could say it's the rise of the sites, right? The sites have actually their voices become they get listened to a little bit more than they were before COVID, I think. So my question is, I think the, kind of your challenges that you have, it seems to me that the two stakeholders you might make uncomfortable within the organization would be the cottage industry sites, okay, who kind of don't like the competition of private equity and they may have their thoughts about that, or the CROs where, actually, many site kind of landscape players seem to want to do more and more of what were traditional CRO services. So we're definitely seeing a trend of sites being able to be kind of like a CRO, right? And I'm just asking how you see that because obviously, you've seen the landscape from multiple angles and how, where the large organizations that you now represent kind of fit into that.
That's a great question, Amir. And actually, that especially the question regarding CROs has come up quite frequently. So my personal opinion is that there will always be a place for CROs. And if you look at the evolution of the CRO marketplace from 25, 30 years ago to where they are today, there's been quite an evolution. I mean, even looking at the membership of ACRO, you've got a lot of the tech suppliers now as members. So I think there's a convergence taking place between technology, what I'll call manpower, being the CRO industry. Those two are kind of merging, if you will. And yeah, I think the sites are going to kind of merge in with that as well in some respects. We're already seeing it where the CROs that have purchased site networks. So how it winds up in the end, my personal opinion, you always need somebody outside of the site network or site individual site to monitor how the site is conducting the trial, right? That's an important aspect. That's going to be a role for CROs. I think FSP is another area where CROs will continue to flourish. I don't see sites doing that.
So it's interesting you bring that up because that was the debate when some of the CROs bought sites, the conflict of interest of being the monitoring organization and owning your own sites. But that, I mean, it seems like that's somehow had been, acceptable with firewalls, I guess, but that's kind of right.
Yeah, that's what they did. They built firewalls, and that works. But it's interesting because when I talk to some of the folks from the CRO networks, because a lot of them reach out to me, they clearly describe how they're two separate business entities. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how this evolves.
It'll be interesting to see, even if that sentiment of firewall is enough reassurance when one private equity firm could theoretically own the IRB and ethics committee, the technology provider, the CRO providing oversight, the site network, essentially everyone but the drug sponsor, could theoretically today roll up under the same PE firm.
You mean a bit like healthcare is like
Well, yeah, and and look, I'm not going to challenge you, Jim, on whether private equity in our industry is a good or a bad thing. I imagine, like most, there's a sense it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But Amir, your question reminded me of a hallway conversation with a site network CEO I will not name. I will put a blue dot over his face on the visual here, who said, on the question of CRO services, why would I want commoditized, low margin business added into my site network? So it is interesting, right, that they are actually, in some cases, very different business models. Jim, Amir had also, though, asked this other stakeholders' perspective with AMRC, the independent sites, those small kind of moms and pops. I think our space today, I feel like we have an archetype of our big medical centers, which have their own challenges today with federal funding of research in this country. We have our site networks, and then we have all the others. Is there going to be oxygen left in the room for those smaller mom and pop sites going forward, or will they ultimately wind up creating networks of their own?
I think there always will be space for them. And let me tell you the reason why. Even if you look at the CRO market, there are niche CRO, small CROs that a lot of them out there that are doing work for, certain types of customer base.
Thousands.
They're all over the place. So I as it relates to sites, as I mentioned earlier, the only we're not trying to say don't use the small mom and pop sites. We're just trying to say change how you think about your site selection process. Doesn't it make sense to go to a professional organization that focuses on conducting clinical trials at the site level first and then fill in the gaps with the small mom and pops? Or again, like I said, if you need academic institutions, fill in the gaps with the academic institutions and the mom and pops. Or if there's a hospital base that you need, fine. And the other thing about the small mom and pops, they're going to appeal, or they're going to have access to to certain types of patient populations, right? So if you need that particular patient population, they're going to offer something that maybe the MCRCs can't offer. So I think there's going to be room for everybody. Now, I personally believe, and this is one of our objectives, is that more of the work will go to the larger institutions like MCRCs, a higher percentage of the work. And the reason we feel this way is like if you look at the staff and how they're hired, trained, and managed, you're going to get less variance, right? Because let's say they own 30 sites, just for sake of argument. All those people are going to be trained the same way, hired the same way. You're going to have people who specialize in data management, people who specialize in contracting, people who specialize in working directly with patients, et cetera, technology. When you go to the small mom and pop shops, you get more, not that they don't do this well, but you're going to get more of a one person jack of all trades that has to do all those different functions. So I like the analogy I like to use is a football team. If you had the opportunity to have a professional football team, wouldn't you want people who specialize in certain positions on that team? You wouldn't want to take the quarterback and make them a linebacker. You wouldn't want to take the center and make them a quarterback. So by having specialized roles as opposed to the jack of all trade, I think we're going to see sponsors over time want to work with the more professionalized organizations. And again, this is not to say that the one-off mom and pop shops aren't effective, because a lot of them are, but it's just that we should be using them to fill in the gaps as opposed to going there first. Does that make sense?
Jim, I have two more related questions quickly. One is, can you just briefly tell us, kind of, you talked about some of your objectives, but right now, your initial objectives, how would you define those for the organization? What are you focused on right now?
Yeah, right now we're focused on establishing the organization in the industry so people know who we are, what we stand for, et cetera. One of the things we're doing for our membership is keeping them up to date on what's going on in the political environment. And at some point, we want to be able to obviously provide, and we do this currently, provide feedback to FDA and other regulatory bodies when they ask for insights.
Yes.
We want to get more engaged with organizations such as yours. As well as Transcelerate. We're working with some sponsors to collect data about our performance or about the performance of MCRCs. So we have a lot of different projects going on in that regard. By the way, I should address this. I apologize. I didn't address the private equity question. That's been interesting in that we've had people from sponsors who are thankfully, open and honest with us, say, one of the things that makes me nervous about using MCRCs is that they're owned by private equity, and we're worried they're going to cut costs and cut quality to keep their expenses down. I get why people feel that way because of what's happened in the overall healthcare market and, some of these acquisitions where they completely rearrange hospital staffing, or they may even close hospitals because they're going after the profitability. But when you talk to the people that work at these sites and the people that understand how sites function, you have to provide good quality. You have to provide good data. It's just like being a CRO. If you're not providing the service you're hired to deliver, the sponsors aren't going to pay for it. Now, in the healthcare environment, it's a little different because insurance companies are paying for what happens in clinical delivery, right? In clinical health delivery, whereas in clinical development, the sponsors are paying for what happens, and they're not going to come back to you if you don't perform. So I don't think this, I mean, I get why people are concerned about cost efficiency and the fact that some of these private equity firms might want to cut back on quality, but the reality is if they do that, they're going to go out of business. So
So, Jim, you could make that argument, but we've seen many vendors who've been ruined by private equity owning them and doing exactly that, cutting costs, and those vendors have actually gone away. So that's assuming the private equity owners understand that and are willing to have a longer term view, right?
absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree,
And
Amir.
I mean, what I was going to ask you was, look, all sites of businesses, even academic ones, whether you're a business or you have other conflicts within the organization or what you have to focus on. So I think it's not just private equity sites that have kind of things they have to manage in terms of conflict of interests. But how do you think you can work on with your organization to exactly that, to make sure that there is some management of, cost constraints versus quality? I think that's an area I see that actually you could do a lot of good to sort of help your member companies assure that, right?
Yeah, great point, Amir. And in fact, that's again, you asked about our goals. I shared with you our short-term goals, but as we go forward, one of the areas we'd like to be involved with is helping set standards. So quality standards, operational efficiency standards, things of that nature.
Great. I've asked enough questions. I'll let Craig Jane or if we were opening it up. I have many more, but I'll stop there.
You ask good ones.
These have been great so far, and I see a
We have
couple of
some weird,
questions,
yeah, in the chat. Yeah, exactly.
yeah, coming through in the chat. Archana is dropping a question that kind of builds on Amir's regarding priorities. She's specifically asking about interests in streamlining technology use, whether it's tech training at member sites. Some of that may even connect to some of the conversations, Jim, I know we've had with DTRA around bring your own technology and ways that sites could make better use of their own tech stack, especially at the scale of some of these larger networks. What's the sentiment right now within AMRC as it relates to technology and technology priorities?
Yeah, again, a great question. So, yes, well, to answer the question that came through the chat, we as an association are not investing in technology, but we are investing in having the conversations around how to best utilize technology. So, again, back to the idea of standards. So, a number of our members are currently investing or have already invested in their own technology to help streamline their operations. One of the things we'd like to do is to get involved in, again, organizations like yours that are looking at cross-industry collaborations on the best approach on how to do these things, right? And then that would then tie back into this concept of what standards make sense for the industry to deploy.
And I'm going to give you and your organization a thank you because you reviewed our draft white paper on bring your own technology, and we incorporated several of the comments that we received. So thank you very much for that. I also think we may be able to work together to help define a couple of other things, like honestly, does the sponsor really need to get involved in some of this technology conversation? Maybe there's some myths we could unpack there. I think a lot about the investigator file. And yes, of course, you need to review it, but it seems like maybe there's a different way we could go about making sure that it has what it needs without dictating what it needs to look like. The other thing is, what about training? How could we simplify the training landscape? And gosh, we've tried that a few times without really making the progress that I hoped we would. So how would you attack that now?
Jane, are you referring to protocol training?
No. Like, if you've used X in this trial for this sponsor, do you have to get retrained on X when you do it?
From a technology perspective.
Or
Yeah,
training,
or even endpoint
like
certifications.
outcome measure training. You're opening up some scar tissue for me, Jane,
I know, I know. I'm
now.
sorry.
Or like GTPs and things like that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, I know TransCelerate took some action about that regarding GCP, and if you were certified, you didn't have to go through it. It's a great point, Jane. I'd be quite frank, I hadn't thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's the kind of thing we could approach, because as it relates, and this kind of ties back to this earlier question, the idea around training, whether it be technology, protocol, the conduct of trials, et cetera. There needs to be a way to document who's already experienced in these things and not retrain them, because it's such a waste of time at the sites. And let's face it, time is money. If you want to cut back on something, let's cut back on over retraining people that don't need to be trained.
And
There's an
Jim,
area.
one of the issues I think all sites have faced, especially after COVID, is just the talent pool retaining people. I mean, staffing has been a real pain for sites. Do you
Yeah.
think your organization will be possibly thinking about that, working on how can we develop that pipeline of talent for the sites?
Yeah, that's another really great question. One of the things that we're currently doing, well, there's two parts to your question. One is the retention and job satisfaction. We're currently getting ready to do a survey with our members to find out what their turnover rates are for PIs and for study coordinators, and we want to compare that against the industry turnover rates. So we'll see whether or not job satisfaction at a MCRC is better than job satisfaction at a smaller site or in an academic setting or even hospital. So we'll find out when we get the data. As a re What was the other part of your question, Amir? I'm sorry.
Just developing a talent pool,
Oh,
and
yeah.
make sure we have a talent pool.
Yeah, it's interesting. We just had a conversation about that yesterday on a call, and the idea would be, it makes a lot of sense to me, is these organizations have PIs that have been PIs for many years. They would be great mentors for people who are interested in coming in. This is my personal opinion, but I think a lot of the doctors that come in to be PIs the first time, they didn't realize what a different business model it is. And that's why we have this whole one and done phenomena. They do it and they go, this isn't what I thought I was getting into, and they leave. So if we have somebody or organizations where these doctors can come in and work with PIs and see how clinical research is conducted and then make a decision, do I want to make a career out of this or not? I think we're going to get better retention. Same with study coordinators for that matter.
I'm going to pitch that they could help train HCPs on how to be involved in the trial without becoming investigators. Not
That's
all of them
enough.
want to be investigators, but a lot of them seem curious about how they could contribute to trial data.
Yeah, good point, Jane. That's true as well.
And Jim, a lot of this conversation feels like it's starting to converge your journey at ACRP, where so much of the energy that that you were driving focused on the workforce and the gaps in our workforce and supporting the workforce. And now some of these insights you're hoping to demonstrate with AMRC that these organizations can sustain their workforce, support them maybe better, and in what ways can we help to incubate a pipeline, whether it's for the investigators or perhaps even that bigger gap around the study coordinators and other site staff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Craig.
There were a couple
Jim,
of questions in the
oh,
chat.
go ahead, Amir. What are you seeing
Just
in the
saying there's a
chat?
couple, well, just confirming that you're not US only, is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, we in fact, several of our members have sites outside the US. Velocity, for example. Pradia just joined recently, and they're primarily in Europe. So, yeah. The group that got together to discuss this prior to them bringing me on, they were primarily US-based, MCRCs, but a lot of them are expanding into other markets around the world. So.
Now, by the way, Jim, my prediction is I think you've worked at Lilly, you've worked at CROs, ACRP, you've done now the sites. I think once you retire from this gig, your next gig is going to be running a organization of patient groups that are doing their own drug development, because that's the only stakeholder left that you have enough to
Well,
organize. So I
Amir,
think that's your next gig.
you'll appreciate this. I've actually been a participant in a trial too.
Yes, I'm aware. Yes, no, absolutely. I'm just making a joke that that could be your next gig after this one. You've done literally every other sector. So.
Oh
Well,
boy, yeah.
Jim, I'd like to double click on that last share of yours. On Clinical Trials Day, we brought in a group of folks who have long careers in the clinical research industry, who have also had some of their journey as a participant in clinical trials. One thing that was noteworthy, by the way, was just how many of them were clinical trial dropouts and found that the burden, even being a well-informed clinical research professional joining a trial, still found the burden to be too great to be able to continue and participate. I think one of your retirements probably was a little bit of retirement from work while you were doing some healing and recovery yourself. Can you share a little bit about your journey as a research participant and maybe how has that impacted your view, your lens on clinical research today?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Craig. That's a good question. So I'll just share with everybody. I got diagnosed with bladder cancer right around, well, it was during COVID. And that was one of the reasons I retired from ACRP, because I knew I was going to be going through a lot of healthcare issues and stuff. So anyway, I went through standard of care, didn't work. The cancer stayed. And then I called this guy that I knew named Craig Lipsett. And To be perfectly honest with you, I'm gonna say I'm a lucky person, because what happened was, Craig, you connected me with an old colleague of mine from Lilly that I didn't realize also had bladder cancer. He connected me. He was very LinkedIn with a lot of different folks, and he connected me with somebody at Johns Hopkins who had trained at IU, Indiana University, which has a very, very good urology cancer center. So I got a referral into there, and I started seeing a urologist there, and I was able to have access to some of the highest or some of the best technology available. The cancer remained after going through another course of therapy, and I got put into a clinic. I was asked if I'd like to be in a clinical trial. It was an open label trial. I did go in, and for about 2 years, my cancer was gone. So it appeared as though the trial was working. But unfortunately, it came back in January of this year. So, to make a long story short, I had to have my bladder removed just about 2 months ago. That's why I couldn't make it to that TGIF that was on that shortly thereafter. I feel great right now. Still a little bit in recovery, but not, I'm probably 95% back to my normal self, if I ever was normal. And then, and yeah, feeling great. But to your question regarding being in the trial, it was really interesting to me because, number one, I feel like the reason I got into the trial is because I was connected into this world of clinical research. If I had been a, I actually tried to go to clinicaltrials.gov and look. I called different places, I emailed different places. Some returned my call, some didn't. Most of them did not respond, quite frankly. It was really difficult. I Googled things. I went to other types of websites where you can get into trials. Didn't have much luck. So I feel like could I have found something eventually? Perhaps. But I'm not a doctor, and so for me, especially in oncology, an area that I'm not terribly familiar with, it was really difficult to work through the terminology in terms of did I qualify or not, And again, I'm in the healthcare business, so I can only imagine what it's like if you're not in the healthcare business to try to find a trial. It must be next to impossible. So that's one element. The other element was some of the positive things is the at IU, they had a patient concierge who actually walked me through everything, connected me with the study coordinator. Sat down with me and the study coordinator when we did the informed consent. I felt very well informed. There were a lot of things that, just finding your way around the hospital as a patient is challenging because they're a maze. So having somebody walk me from the urology department to the infusion area to the radiology department, et cetera, was really, really helpful. So I would highly encourage any organization to have that type of a role. So there are some other things that I feel like I learned, but it was, it's a high tech business we're in. It's very difficult for people to really have a full understanding of what they're getting themselves into. And as it relates to patient burden, that's one last thing I should cover. Fortunately for me, I'm semi-retired. I was semi-retired, so I could get from Michigan to Indiana or from Washington, D.C. to Indiana when I needed to, without it disrupting my family life or my work life. Not everybody's in that situation. In fact, most people aren't. So again, I feel very, very fortunate that I had the experience that I did, but I recognize that for others, it could be very, very difficult.
I got a quick question. Was your navigator somebody who had been through their own personal journey or like a patient who's recovered, or was it a clinical staff member of the IU center?
She was a clinical staff member.
I got it.
Yeah.
That's cool. I've seen both models. I think we need more of them.
Yeah. Well, the patient advocacy group that represents bladder cancer is called Beacon, BCAN. And they do have people who will walk you through sort of their experience. Fortunately for me, the guy that Craig connected me with helped me a lot in terms of what to expect. What questions to ask, things of that nature.
Jim, is there anything we haven't asked you about the new organization or anything else that you would like to get across to our audience? Is there something we haven't really asked you that you would like to have talked about?
I don't think so. I think again, I think the as I mentioned earlier, we're just trying to raise awareness of who we are. We're trying to raise awareness that we think this market's going to continue to evolve. And we think that as the industry begins to recognize the value, and this is what we want to communicate, the value that we can bring in speed as well as quality, we're going to see more and more organizations strategically aligning with MCRCs.
One theme that I heard from you right from the beginning of this conversation was that data is a big part of how you operate. So I'm curious, how could we help you with that data, or how can we even respond to data that you gather?
Oh, great question. As far as gathering the data, I'd have to think about that a little bit, Jane. But I think that I think you can help us disseminate the data when once we have it available. By sharing it with your members, doing things like this, the webinars, et cetera. Hopefully we'll get some publications out. But I think if as long as we continue to partner with you and help provide the voice of the sites, particularly the MCRC type of sites, I think that's where the biggest opportunities are for us to collaborate. Because I think there is a lot of opportunity with what you're doing to help patients and to help with from a technology perspective, that would be very, very useful for the MCRCs. And Craig, we've kind of talked about this a little bit.
Jim, is it surprising that more of the MCRCs are not offering themselves as central sites or meta sites, that there seem to be only a handful that have their own home health or visiting nurses to kind of own and control the process and, quite honestly, own and control the revenue attached?
Greg, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that question, to be quite frank. I'll have to ask around a little bit to see what I can learn about that. But this is my my opinion for what it's worth. I think that the focus now for a lot of these organizations is growth and having a presence, a physical presence in a lot of different markets so they can attract a lot of different types of patients to meet the needs of the CROs and sponsors they're working with.
Well, that's a great point. I imagine it's a hard, like we were talking about earlier, for patient recruitment, making the jump from one therapeutic area to the next. Certainly, a lot of these organizations exploded with growth during the pandemic, with an emphasis on vaccines. Today, maybe vaccine clinical development is not hot, and maybe there's more attention in neuro, in oncology, and in rare as examples. Or, of course, in metabolic and cardiovascular. Is it hard for some of these groups to make jumps across therapeutic areas?
I think for some it is. Others have a more broad base of investigators and sites. But some are more focused on one or two therapeutic areas.
Usually I see you're either in onc or not. But maybe that is getting a little more blurry now.
Yeah, it's funny, Jane. When I was at Lilly, we had five business units based on therapeutic areas. And we would come up with all these, procedures and things. And oncology always used to say to us, "Oncology is different." And I didn't believe it. I'm like, "No, oncology, it is. Oncology is different, just because of where the patients, what they're dealing with, number one, where they tend to see their healthcare providers. It's a lot different. In fact, to me, oncology is like a whole different ball game, and each of the different diseases within oncology are unique in their own way. So I'm a firm believer now. They converted me.
We'll talk more about that offline. Amir tells me that onc is easy relative to other therapeutic areas. We
In some
debate. I didn't
ways,
say
harder
easy.
in others.
Yeah, no, I didn't say easy, but it's, yeah, no, but you know what it is? Every therapeutic area is special in its own way.
Yeah, for sure. And
Very
every
true.
protocol is a snowflake. right? So we got a double whammy there.
I'm going to use that one, Jane.
Oh, I think that's a Michelle Longmire or someone else, but I heard her say it, so it's not my original
They
thought.
are, but maybe that's part of our problem, is that
Yeah.
we are treating these studies like each one is a unique work of art on a fresh piece of canvas rather than trying to normalize and standardize procedures, visit schedules, and the like that really aren't that unique from one protocol to the next. We just use slightly different hues and blends of paint that make them look unique and therefore require all of this additional work, training, oversight, and all the quality issues that we kind of end up surfacing as a result.
That's a whole debate we can have. Yeah, it's really
Yeah,
interesting.
let's go. Okay, but we are at the top of the hour for today. So I would like to thank our guest this week, Jim Kramitis. Thank you, Jim, for sharing your entire story from the origin stories of entering clinical research in the Lilly days decades ago, the journey through ACRP and sort of carrying on with that organization around workforce as a pandemic ensues, your own personal journey as a patient and research participant, and now this latest chapter with multi-site research corporations. This is really fun and exciting to see. I'm glad that you only retire intermittently. And for folks that have enjoyed what Jim has to say, you will enjoy equally what Jim's hands create. And so be sure to check out on Spotify, look him up under Chromitis, because there is some really delightful original acoustic content there that I sincerely enjoy, whether I'm in the car or just looking to wind down.
Thanks, Craig. Two beers I owe you now.
Jim, thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Amir. Great questions, Jane. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care of yourself.
Bye now. Will do.